I make a motion to approve the minutes of the April 2nd.
Any discussion? No. All in favor?
Aye.
Yes, he's supposed to have one with Dr. Smith.
Are you here for primarily or 221?
Yes, I am.
So if we did that first.
We'll start with our resolution 156. You want to move for discussion?
So, Legislator Bartels and I are happy to use the public hearing for a lot of support for the legislation. There were comments that we received primarily from the New York State Merchants Association and the New York State Baking Association raising some concerns. I felt that those generally raised issues that we have addressed, that concerns that the law would be ineffective. We felt that was poorly substantiated claims. It has been affected in areas that have enacted it. And the Vaping Association posited that vaping could be beneficial. There is some evidence that in adult smokers, vaping may be helpful in cutting back on or ceasing to smoke, but the available evidence with people and adolescents is that it does not show that, and that it may lead to introduction of tobacco products. The one comment that we thought merited some attention was a question about our claim in the legislative intent, section 1C, that almost 1 in 5 high school seniors is a current cigarette smoker. They challenged that from New York State. The claim is probably a federal claim, but we decided to have up-to-date local information might be better, and the 2016-2017 survey of Ulster County students shows that almost 1 in 3 high school seniors in Ulster County has tried cigarettes. So we propose changing that finding in the legislative intent and findings, and we'd like to do that tonight in this committee so that it goes to further committees and people see what with that language.
Just to follow on that, because it's in the legislative intent and findings, it's a non-substantive change, so it wouldn't require a public hearing.
Right. Yeah, I don't even know if this would, you changed it yourself, right? I mean, are we even going to have to vote on this?
That's
fine. Okay.
I'd like to go for a committee, sure. And then vote for, and then on the floor,
on the resolution as a whole.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Are you thinking about your writing in your last week?
No.
I just want to say how lucky we are to be able to do this. So, put that in the record.
Previewed this resolution at the Ways and Means Committee last month, saying that we were having some staff issues at the Department of Social Services with regard to our foster care and our preventative services unit. So before I turn it over to the commissioner and Cindy Mizell to speak to the program behind it, I also just want to share, I at the time had talked about, we were unsure how we were going to propose funding the position, and you talked about using contingency. Since we filed the resolution, this will be budget neutral. So a couple of weeks ago, we were notified by the state of New York that our anticipated weekly Medicaid payment that's in the state will be slightly less than what we had anticipated. So we're going to pay for that with dollars that are currently in the social services budget. And the way that we're basically, we're taking dollars that we would have paid to Medicaid that are 100% county dollars, and now we're going to pick up a reimbursement rate of anywhere from 62 to 70%. So the actual county impact of the proposal is modest, and I believe we can sustain the staffing, you know, much into the future is the way that we structured it. So there's no concern from contingency, and I believe that we paid for this to finish up 2017, and when we budget next year, we'll be able to absorb this additional staffing without any other impacts. So, turn over to Commissioner Imposi.
Sure. Thank you for the invitation to be here and be able to address the committee about this issue. We've had ongoing discussions with Ken in connection with our staffing needs as well as the caseload. They're obviously closely connected to one another. Really beginning in 2016 and then continuing throughout 2017, and now that we're 4 months into 2018, we've seen some trends that I'm sure you're all familiar with that are being reported not only here in New York and Ulster County but nationwide regarding the opioid epidemic and the impact that it's having on families. And what we've seen as a result of that circumstance is increase in our caseloads across the board. Ken mentioned that we're affected in our preventive services and our foster care unit, but it also affects our child protective services and investigations, because with increase in the number of incidences that the state central registry gets, where we have to go out and conduct investigations and then take action for children who we determine are experiencing imminent risk of their safety and well-being, who then come into our custody where we have to provide services for. Obviously, our caseloads have increased. I see some of you have the information that we provided about the increases that we've been experiencing. I think the most compelling numbers are in foster care, because that really emphasizes how widespread this issue is. as recently as 2014 and 2015, we were averaging about 120 children being in the care and custody of the department. And those are children who come into our care and custody because they've either been removed by us or they've been voluntarily surrendered by their biological parents. And while they're in our custody, we're obviously working on permanency with regard to finding permanent placements. But that ended up increasing over 2017 and 2016 to the point now where we have 167 children in care. So that's a fairly significant increase. And what's also been so challenging about these cases are that many of the children that are coming into our care and custody are coming into our care and custody right at birth. They test positive tox at the hospital, and a lot of the birth mothers, unfortunately, because of how devastating the opioid addiction is, have arrived at a point where they're giving birth and they've alienated themselves from any resources that they have. Many of them are often not in any relationships, don't have any family support, don't have any friendships. And there are very limited resources at that point when we learn of these circumstances. So many infants are coming into our care and custody. And this has been something that, again, it's not unique to Ulster County. It's a statewide issue. So in connection with this circumstance that we're trying to be responsive to, we've been tracking our staffing. Cindy and I were talking about it earlier today about how that in 2016 and 2017, we had about 5 caseworkers over the course of each year end up leaving their position. Most of those were due to retirements. This year already, in the first 4 months of 2018, we've had 7 people leave their caseworker positions. This has been a result of some retirements, but it's also a very strong job market. So they're leaving their positions for other positions. So when you look at the fact that in the last 2.5 years we've lost about 17 caseworkers, that's a tremendous amount of institutional experience, subject matter experience, and then the training curve for new caseworkers is such that to get somebody hired under the civil service process, which we have to comply with, and we're well aware of that, and it's a strong process. It helps us to identify qualified candidates. But once people are hired, it's about a 6 to 9 month time frame for them to go through the basic foundations training that Office of Children and Family Services provides. So when we have somebody inform us of the fact that they're resigning, retiring, or taking another job, we then know that their caseload of 15 or 20 cases, it's going to be a long time before we have somebody to be able to come in and take over that caseload. Preventive services is a different type of caseload. Those are children that are either placed with their relatives or remain in their households, and they are deemed at imminent risk of potentially having to be removed, and that's what gives them preventative status. We've seen that caseload grow from about 226 to 309. So there again, a lot of that's attributable to the opioid epidemic. And these are families where we're desperately trying to get them the services that they need to be able to remain intact. The relative placements is something that is obviously an important resource because it helps them maintain the family connections. So foster care, preventive, I've tried to lay out and summarize for you what we've seen. So it's been that dynamic alongside the turnover we've had with staffing that has made us arrive at this point where in anticipation of what our continuing needs are going to be, we're making this request for 3 new positions.
And then just give some more color on that, too. So in last year, we added 4 positions to the CPS unit. And then as people come in kind of through the front door, we need additional staff to service those kids in our care. So that's really what we're seeing right now is we, you know, this, and we're also trying to build a scenario where appreciating the time it takes for someone to actually take a caseload, and by having a couple of additional positions, we're going to build a stronger bench so that, you know, as people get trained, and this is very hard work for $45,000 a year. I mean, you're involving yourselves in a family's crisis, and it's a real toll on people. And it's seen not only with the entry-level staff, but with the more senior workers, the supervisors that do this work really are involved in all hours of the day and night. In fact, Commissioner Iacocca, talking to him, and he, a weekend does not go by when he has to, you know, his phone rings at all hours of the night to authorize actions by the department, and it's been stressful, and he's been also, the workload has been just tremendous.
We have really dedicated
staff. Yeah.
We also are fortunate to have a lot of longevity on our staff and supervisory positions, and you know, the people that are doing this work feel supported. The reason that the telephone does ring is that somebody has a question, and we can assist and support them based on our experience by being able to be responsive to that question. But we continually, you know, see new scenarios that have to be able to be responded to. Another really positive dynamic is we do have staff that move between preventive and foster care and CPS and FAR. And maybe you've been in one of those units for a couple of years and you've decided that you need to be doing something a little bit different, because what's involved in being a foster care caseworker is a little bit different than being a CPS investigator. The attachments that you forge with the children and the families, depending upon what their needs are, can be unique. So we've seen that quite frequently, and we have a tremendous number of dedicated staff who are, you know, also answering this call right now. And I think that, you know, we're incredibly fortunate that they're there with regards to the new hires that are going to be coming on board, because being able to shadow experienced caseworkers and learn from those experiences is going to put them in a position to be able to do their job well going forward.
When you talk about losing personnel and caseworkers to other jobs, are they moving to? Are they moving to the private sector, or are we paying competitively? I mean, why do you
think we're paying competitively?
This is entry level, and we pay for the training. We have some staff that come in and you can just decide this isn't for them. It's not our job. You just get done with a core training, and about 4 months later, we just had people go, I don't really like this, without having another job. And this isn't my thing. We've had, you know, people that wanted to transfer to OSA. We just lost somebody to probation. We just started seeing people being offered state jobs. Somebody left for OCFS for a training position, and she had family up there, so.
Okay.
Somebody left for Westchester Medical.
She just decided, you know, therapy here wasn't the thing, and I want to go back to a hospital setting, so I was just curious.
Everybody wants to be a probation.
We occasionally have people come back, too.
So that's something that we always look forward to. We've terminated a couple of people.
Some people have not passed
the probationary period,
But it's been a real mix.
It's been a lot. We've seen a lot.
But I think normally, you know, we'll take an action. Let's say that you approve this and we take this action. We'll be set for a while. We'll be dealing with this issue all summer. There's so much we'll be going on.
You have somebody go out and have a baby. You know, there's a loss of, you know, 8 to 9 months. You can take up to your year with the county, so there's another caseload that gets absorbed.
Right.
And we've had a few babies born over in foster care, over in adult services.
I did have one other question. I've noticed for the first time signs around the county, definitely in my district, about fostering. Are you interested in fostering? Is that something that... Where is that happening? Is that from within the department? You're aggressively trying to reach out?
We have a really strong home finders program. We have two individuals who are dedicated home finders, and they work with training and recruitment of foster parents. There's also private organizations that do a lot of advertising around that, but we all contribute to different activities and events around trying to encourage people in the community that might be interested in doing that. The more foster parents that we're able to certify through our recruitment and training program, I think the better equipped we are when it comes to having to make placements, because we get to know those families and we get to know where their interests are. Some are only interested in respite. They don't want to have placements that are going to be for any permanent length of time. Some also express an interest in possible adoption. if that looks like it's something that might be on the horizon. So, you know, definitely with everything that has been going on with the increasing caseload, we're really fortunate that there's been increased interest in that activity.
Do we have enough families that are willing, or homes that are willing to be foster families?
You know, with the increase, we can always use more.
Yeah. We're in a good place.
Yeah.
We have really made significant strides in the past few years in terms of the number of families that we have been able to certify. So we're in a good place with that, but we're always working hard on it. Right now, we have a MAP training going on with about 10 new families that we expect to certify by the end of May. And we usually do two MAP trainings in a year, one in spring and one in the fall.
MAP is?
MAP is our foster care training program.
Maybe that's
what
the
acronym is.
Put their GFS
in
place.
No. Then I stand up.
My acronym failed me tonight.
Maybe before the next training, that would be an idea. In all our various trainings, we talk about ideas for public service announcements, maybe in advance of the next training. That would be an idea that we talk about in public service announcements, just to really let people know in the community that there's always room for more. I mean, I think that would be a great problem to have too many homes, because you're trying to place children of school age in their districts, right? So I'm assuming.
We do, yeah, absolutely. I know I got the last two principals in parenting. The other two. I'm pretty sure.
It's hard to think about the job if you have to plan all the effort.
So how many caseworkers do you have now, and what is their current caseload?
Close to 50 caseworkers, and their caseloads are between 15 and 25 on average. There's been legislation discussed at the state level for mandating caseload limits, but it's never actually been arrived at getting too far, because the needs of most other counties in order to retain some flexibility around, and some people, depending on the nature of the case, 10 cases can be more challenging than 20 other kinds of cases. So they've been, you know, at least considerate of the fact that, you know, giving us the autonomy and discretion around caseloads. And we're constantly having conversations and meetings with caseworkers around that.
Who says those four enough?
I think we're asking for three.
Three, but
not through the typo.
No.
I mean, I'm here sitting with all of you. We feel like we can always use more, but we're also trying to be prudent about what we've seen in terms of the trends and what we think we're going to be experiencing. And we also know that we're allowed to come back again.
These are three new positions as well.
It would not be common, again, it's not common for us to come in here with this type of request, but again, given the circumstance, given what, you know, our experience tells us receiving caseload, the safe play is that if we're asking positions now versus waiting for the next budget.
We're trying to get out in front of it now. We have felt that when we looked at the numbers in the middle of last year and we requested the four new positions that we thought, I can remember myself saying, you know, we wouldn't have to be worried about this in 2018. And then 2 months into 2018, you know, the volume of cases continues to increase, the number of kids in our care and custody. So we started the conversation with Ken and said that, you know, this is a trend that doesn't seem to be stopping. So.
And you're also finding it's a trend where relatives aren't taking the kids?
No, I think relatives are continuing to step forward.
Yeah, they do provide services. Yeah. For example, when you mentioned Celebrating Families, let's talk about that. That's a program that they haven't heard about that we've been doing.
Okay, Celebrating Families is a specific program that we do through our Family Court Family Treatment Program, which is drug court, basically. So these are families that are identified at the time that petitions are filed in Family Court around abuse or neglect that has been arrived at because of the underlying drug addiction. And Celebrating Families is a 12-week-long program where
the families are brought together to sit down for a meal, and then after the meal, the parents and the children go into adult and child activities, and there's counseling and therapy for both groups, and then at the end of the evening there's a group activity. And it's been demonstrated to be an incredibly effective program. We're in our third phase. We ran two of these phases in 2017. We're in the middle of our first one for, maybe our second one for 2018.
Yeah.
And what we're finding is we're getting a completion rate at about 95%. We're also arriving at being able to reunify families sooner. Judge Mizell, who is the family court judge that presides over family treatment court, has been very involved. And we're finding that the bonds that are created by having the family participate in this activity are very strong. They also become available to support each other. I've attended several of the sessions, and it's really one of the most remarkable programs that I've ever seen. I mean, the most moving part of the program is how the kids support each other. The kids who are siblings and the kids who need each other. And by being able to sit down, and this is something that some of these families have really never been able to do on a consistent basis, to be able to do it even one evening a week and to look forward to it and to count on it. It's every Monday right now. And we're also beginning to do reunions for the families that have completed celebrating families. And the recurrence and relapse are part of the addiction process, and sometimes that does happen, and that's when it's even more essential to be there to be a support and to not feel that the fact that someone has had a relapse or a recurrence around this means that they're not going to continue to have the support that they require. So it's been an incredible program.
Yeah, there's a lot of credit to Barbara Sorkin, that if you're not making tonight, she doesn't know what it's been next. But so when we first talked about this, we cobbled this together with a small amount of grant funding, mm-hmm. and over time. And
you created here in Ulster?
Which is an evidence-based program we brought to Ulster here. In fact, commissioners have been spoken in Albany about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone's looking at it like, oh, you're getting a good result. So looking at it. And we cobbled together with Bubblegum on the Shoestring. And,
mm-hmm.
and again, to hear the stories about these kids and to actually understand that for a lot of these children, it's the first time they have a meal with their parents. That, you know, they their family dynamic is such that you don't have dinner with your parents. And it's just create that kind of a family environment and, you know, show that this is the, you know, this is how families are can interact, right? And you change that dynamic and it's not so positive. It's
a really great program.
Yeah.
And we're continuing to seek grant funding currently involved in a dialogue with the Casey Foundation, which is a national foundation that supports reunification of children with their families. So they're very interested in this particular program, so we're hoping they're going to come and participate in observing the program and that we'll be able to continue to increase the funding. And the county has also always been extremely supportive. I mean, Ken mentioned evidence-based programs that generate data, which supports continuing to allocate funds, and that's an important dynamic, and the county is always interested and aware of that. But, you know, we also want to continue to make sure Ulster County and Ulster County DSS is a name that's coming up in conversations around grants. We want to make sure that, you know, when money becomes available, whether it's from private sources or from other government programs at the state or federal level, that they're aware of us and the things we're trying to do.
You said you don't hear that often. Do you want to talk about safe harbor? You're interested in hearing that about a minute?
Sure. Safe harbor is a program that focuses on addressing sex and labor trafficking of youth. It has its origins in data that was compiled at the federal level and resulted in some legislation called Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families, which really arrived at determining that many children that come into the child welfare system as a result of their circumstances underlying trauma become victims of sex and labor trafficking, because many of them end up AWOLing from their placements, being out on their own or on company's use. So when that information was arrived at, the federal government implemented that legislation, which then required New York State as well as other states to put a screening tool into our connection system so that all of the kids that come to our system are screened through this tool to determine whether or not they've been exposed to trafficking. If it's determined that they are exposed to trafficking, then there's a comprehensive assessment done for more specific services. OCFS, in response to this, came up with a program called Safe Harbor, and it's a five-year grant program, which most counties throughout the state have now signed up for. We were one of the first counties to sign up for it back in 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, so we're in our fourth year of the program. The reason that we had signed up for it was that I had identified the Preventing Sex Trafficking and Trafficking Families legislation as a link. So some of my activities with the New York Public Welfare Association led me to volunteer our county to be one of the first safe harbor counties. So again, we're in our fourth year of that program. It's been a grant program where we basically raise community awareness around sex and labor trafficking. We train the professionals, and we're also trying to embed the services. Next year will be our last year of the grant, and we've already had discussion, or Cindy and I, about how we can arrive at sustainability. But it is something that, because of what's been accomplished so far, it's just another area of subject matter that our professionals now consider and evaluate the kids for. It's been challenging because the subject matter is not something that people are generally aware of, and there's some discomfort around it. A lot of kids that are involved in sex trafficking are perceived to be promiscuous, reckless, troublemaking, and choosing to do this. We're trying to decriminalize it. We're trying to change the culture around it. If these are not kids that are out there on the corner. There is no such thing as a child prostitute under the law now.
Drugs can interfere with that.
Drugs can also be a factor, coercion, survival sex. The LGBTQ community is particularly vulnerable. Many of the youth that get involved in this, for the first time in their lives, they're getting the attention, and they're getting it in the context of a relationship where they feel like someone actually cares for them, even though they're being manipulated and exploited. So it's very hard for some of the youth who are being victimized by this to even understand that it's going on. Even within our own service providers and our own activities, it's still a very difficult dynamic to embrace. And much like domestic violence, 2 or 3 decades ago, was enormously underreported, not really treated as an issue. You know, she's just acting up, right? You know, she'll be better in the morning. It's not the reality. Elder abuse prevention is another area of enormously underreported activity that we're starting to try to shine a light on. So, Celebrating Families, our Safe Harbor program, our Elder Abuse Prevention Task Force, our DB, Interagency Council, and we're trying to make headway into all of these areas on a very consistent basis.
A couple questions. With Safe Harbor, have you identified, are there many cases in Ulster County? Have you identified?
There are cases here in Ulster County where we're identifying cases among the youth population and also adult cases as well. So, and we report quarterly to OCFS, and they have data about the cases that we're identifying. And again, a major goal of the Safe Harbor program is to, in your existing infrastructure, train professionals and embed this subject matter so that we can respond appropriately. And OCFS has been incredibly supportive around doing that. And I think any grant program that lasts for 5 years reflects the challenges associated with changing perspectives around that type of subject matter. Here we are. We've had some high-profile cases that have actually been reported in the media, and then we've had many referrals that have come in through children that are in our care or through other service providers in the community.
And such important work. And
I'm really happy to hear about Celebrating Families because I didn't know about it before tonight. And just knowing, I would imagine that a program like that, when successful, helps to keep children out of the other programs that probably cost more money and more emotional damage, not just about the financial. One other question. Earlier you said 167, you're up to 167 children in foster care. Is that on a, is that the average on a daily basis, or what?
That was February. That was February.
But on any given day, that's on the average on any given day.
I think we might even be a little bit higher as of now.
Yeah,
I mean, we could be removing a child right now,
right,
and that number could go up, you know, tomorrow. So the increase that we've seen has been, you know, fairly significant, and most of it is attributable to the opioid epidemic in some way, shape, or form. And the other thing, when we begin to drill down deeper with the families affected by this, we see other underlying trauma. We see biological parents who were abused or neglected at some point in their life, and the drug use is a result of trying to cope with that trauma.
Right.
So it's really peeling the layers back and trying to be responsive to what you find. I mean, there's always going to be some other kind of trauma that's generally associated with the opioid use.
I want to say that, you know, I hope, and I know, I guess, if you need more, you'll come back to us, just speaking as one legislator. Just so, as a body, the body as a whole, I think, probably doesn't know or appreciate all the details of what you do. It's important that we hear about it, I think, more often, just so that we're all educated to it, and that you and your staff have the comfort level and the latitude to be able to fill these gaps in the staffing you're talking about. So just speaking for myself, you know, it's great that we found the money, but if we needed the money, this is something that I'd be ready to vote on in a special meeting at short notice. We're talking about our most vulnerable citizens and its model approaches to parenting partnerships and parenting.
I appreciated it ways and means. The indication I got was, you know, buy the money.
Given the
time of the year and where we are, I would not want to bring you a resolution that cuts services at this point in the year. That's why it was only spoke to contingency, and quite frankly, if you needed to be there, I'd be here tonight talking about contingency. I got the right notice at the right time from the state, so it helps. So.
I really appreciate your recognition and anybody who has kept track of what's been unfolding with regard to this opioid activity realizes that it's, no one is immune. It's affecting every single part of our population. And all you have to do is review obituaries and see that, you know, people are being lost. And you know, that is also affecting our most vulnerable part of the population, where there are other issues of trauma, economic insecurity, mental illness, other substance abuse that can be gateways to this, employment challenges. So we see all of these dynamics, absolutely, and the intersectionality of all of these issues. You know, we do feel very supported by administration and the legislature. We're incredibly fortunate to have a lot of longevity in our department across the board in terms of our management team and our supervisors. So notwithstanding the challenges that we're faced right now, I don't think we could be more well-equipped. I think the relationships that we forged with service providers and not-for-profits and partners and other counties has been also extremely strong. So I think that everything's looking like we're exactly where we need to be. Now, that being said, the random, unpredictable nature of insidious kinds of epidemics of this nature or that we just have to continue to, you know, be prepared to respond.
Right.
And with a lot of consideration and kindness, because I think, you know, what keeps a lot of people from reaching out for help is the difficulty of how they'll be perceived. So we really have to make sure that they know that that's what our purpose is, that we're there to help. I mean, there's some other exciting pro Catholic charities.
Yes.
Who's a major provider. Dr. Smith knows about this. They're doing a mobile outreach project in Ulster and Sullivan County. They're embedded in Orange County and facilities where they provide all types of screening, assessment, and long-term clinical treatment. And they're coming, they've come into Ulster and Sullivan, and they're doing mobile outreach because of the rural nature of our county, with a goal in mind to do screenings, to do assessments, and to do referrals for permanent treatment. So I'm hoping, you know, we're going to see some of the numbers that, you know, we've realized have affected.
There's no question. I mean, yeah, we talked about the impact with respect to our ME situation, with the numbers of both fatal overdoses and the increases in the numbers of those that we've been seeing over the last couple of years really hit us hard, because certainly all of the, you know, the process during the autopsies and all of the systems that surround that whole ME program, including the tox screens that you have to do these days to determine what are the substances in the decedent's bodies, etc., that, and the fact that we can't bill for it, that it's, you know, unfortunately 100% cut county dollars, and, you know, and it's really due to the opioid situation, you know, there's no question. So you're right, they're all interconnected, and, you know, these are the outcomes now that we're forced as a community to try to deal with and manage.
I agree with the thing we did it ourselves in terms of this additional funding. We have strong support here for that. And it, Tracy comments make me think maybe we should think about whether we, it's been a while, as we have done it in the past, doing private Ulster County for foster parents, and maybe raise the profile of that as we're, because, you know, I think we'd be expecting that with these additional stressors, we'll probably have additional needs. So maybe this time, if we haven't done that before, to do it, and if we have done it, to do it again.
Maybe even to talk to Ken about the remaining a month for to recognizing foster parents and doing a, like a full presentation.
Okay, I see, right? I know it's really something business, but since the commissioner's still here, it's also who. Recall, over the last couple of years, there's been discussion here at committee level with regard to our contracts with foster care providers, the facilities where we place children. And we went through a period of time where, you know, we were constantly coming back to you for amendments to those contracts because of the pool of children that we were placing in these facilities, the mix was changing. And so we were constantly amending contracts to make sure there was not to exceed dollars. And the last time we dealt with that, well, now we're not going to be able to spend more than we budgeted, so let's just, you know, raise the not to exceed in all the contracts. And we at the time we chose $3 million. But then Patrice in particular, you were like, what is this? My God, you authorized $1 billion in spending. And the chairman had raised some concerns about it too. So we revisited that. So next month you're going to see, I believe it'll be next month, the whole slate of contracts back. And what we've done is we've put them in tranches. So the real high-use facilities, you're going to see at a $3 million level. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to see like a $2 million tranche, a $1 million tranche, and then there's a tranche that are under 50 that we're going to handle administratively. So we've got to put them into tranches so, you know, it'll give us the flexibility that we need with regard that we're not constantly doing paperwork to move money. We'll give you some comfort that you're not, you know, authorizing this huge sum of money that we've never, you know, budget that enough to pay. So
maybe if next month that's happening next month, maybe that's kind of about it as well.
Yeah, right.
To bring attention to the family.
Yeah.
So the Medicaid money that you did get in, that was reimbursement for expenses through the state. Did that come out of TSS or for services?
So it's a little different than that.
Okay.
One of my claims to fame is that when I worked in Albany for all those years, so many years ago now, we changed the way that we pay for Medicaid. And before, counties would pay a percentage of every service that was delivered. We would pay a certain 50% of the non-federal share for most services, and then 20% of the non-federal share for long-term care services. And that's the way it lasted since the 60s. Well, several years ago, we changed it so that counties now pay a fixed amount of money based upon what our historical spending is. So Ulster County pays about $37 million a year. That's a fixed amount of money, and just over $37 million, and it doesn't increase. It's just a fixed amount of money.
Doesn't increase, you meant the service?
Correct.
Doesn't increase.
Right, so it's called Medicaid cap. So originally when the cap was first put in place, I showed the law, it's on my wall in my office, but it had an escalator built into it, so it would grow approximately 3% a year. One of the things, the little positive things that Governor Cuomo did when he came into office, he changed that so that it's now a fixed amount with no escalator. So, for counties, so I could tell you today, what our Medicaid bill will be next year, the year after, and 10 years from now. And anybody appreciates how you do budgeting at a county level, and that kind of predictability is gold.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, I know what we're going to pay. So that's how bring a lot of the financial stability that we see today. Is things like that have helped us do that. And but the good news is we pay a historical share, but as things have happened at the federal level, whether there's been a temporary increase in the federal match rate for the federal medical assistance percentage, it's a formula based upon, every state, depending on what category they fall, they receive a match for every dollar that they spend. So in New York State, we receive a 50% match for every Medicaid dollar we spend, we get a 50% back. Though we're capped, when those enhancements have happened at the federal level, it's served to lower our share. So this year, there's some additional money that's related to the Affordable Care Act, where there's an enhanced Medicaid percentage. And again, it's an adjustment. So when they did the calculations and notified us what our weekly shares would be, this is just a couple of weeks ago. It's about $7,000 a week. It's about $380,000 annually of dollars that we would have had to expend that we don't have to spend. So those are dollars that we've identified to help cover costs. And due to the kind of the magical reimbursement, and you look at the resolution, it shows you that there's no county share. Because essentially we're taking money that we had budgeted that's 100% county money, and we're able to draw a substantial reimbursement of federal and state dollars in this other category of service. So, yeah, so it worked out very well for us. So again, that's how we were able to structure this. Again, I feel confident to tell you that we can pay for it with no impact this year. I believe that we can support the additional staff going forward as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
I think you had mentioned earlier that you were thinking about having we could have a meeting over at the Department of Social Services committee at the time. We just redid all the carpet from the 1980s, so I think you have a really good time to visit over there.
We're out of the mall.
Is there any particular programming you'd like to learn more about when we do it?
Back when the New Deal came through and special services or welfare came in, the caseworkers would go to homes and do home visits and education, and it was supposed to be a temporary service. I'm almost thinking now, after watching Generations and Generations, and I worked at Russell for a while, because it is generational as far as Section 8 goes, if it would be an investment in our community to have more caseworkers there to actually do this outreach. And that may even be the trend with some of these kids ending up in the foster care system, because their parents aren't raising them because they weren't raised. They don't understand, the family values, are going to work, and it's, you know, it's social services, but it's just a check that comes in. You know, there's really no education. So honestly, I'm more interested in that program and what we can do to improve it, if we're allowed to, because I know it's mandated and regulated, and, you know, but I would like to see home visits.
We definitely could put that in the general rubric of our early childhood services, and really taking a look at all that we are doing. I'm also curious about our relationships with the private providers and how services are provided in the community. So it would be good to just have that kind of big view.
Maybe sort of general overview of our activities of the department.
The suggestion might be just to provide us with a list of questions that you have, and then maybe we could arrive at how we could be responsive. I do want to assure you that home visits are still an important component of much of the work that we do around preventive. They do. I mean, those caseworkers who have that as part of their responsibility, you know, particularly with our preventive caseload, those are children who are in families that are identified as being at imminent risk. So between our caseworkers and our service providers, we are doing home visits, and we are also bringing in services. So we can definitely provide you with some information around that.
I know that you know, you often hear people with their preconceived notions about the Department of Social Services, and you know, that free money from the government that's available. And, you know, in breaking those myths, this is one of the important things that we did. Maybe we can have kind of have that conversation. Could you do the Mythbusters presentation?
Yeah, what we focused on, if we make this thing for the home. Because there is a lot of stigma, and there's a lot of misconceptions that goes on. And most of what goes on is people don't realize the amount of education and work and you know, the things that you guys see down on people, not just as a job emotionally as well. So I think the more that people learn and know what goes on, the more you know, the less stigma there will be, and the less preconceived notions about it. So you know, would be beneficial.
And also, do we have any programs like the, are you familiar with the GAP program that they had years ago? It was a transitional program. I was involved in it. It slowly weaned you off of social services.
CAP, CAP, the cash assistance program.
But that was a really good program because it did parent training. It was a pilot program through the state. They really helped you get established so you could get off and sell.
So I mean, one other thing that we're trying to accomplish this year department-wide is training our whole staff around being trauma-informed, culturally competent. We also want to bring in potentially Planned Parenthood, LGBTQ, and possibly some of the immigration service providers, just to increase awareness and sensitivity to continuing to encourage those populations to come for help. Because if they remain in the community and they're basically not receiving any support, that's where they can find themselves in circumstances where they are being exploited, abused, involved in criminal activity. So that's another thing that we're also trying to accomplish, bring in some of the service providers and make sure that we're doing training around that.
Before we adjourn, can we, I don't know if we can do this, I'm going to try, send the good wishes to all the intending births for members of this committee. Families, I think, in this committee, and we're expecting
Got twins, anything.
That's allowed.
for you.
I get two different reactions. From women, it's always like, oh, that's so wonderful. From men,
traffic notification, if it would substantially change it. That seems to be where most of the objections are coming in from. It's referring to anything as PNR. And again, this is just supposed to, in the spirit of everything, be a notification law. It's not supposed to be supporting PNR. It's not. So I have a feeling if he said it would substantially change it, we'll have to come back and bring it forward again. Yeah.
We're doing a ceremony. It's so beautiful.
It was. Well, you ever got to work here? Oh, God, you really.